With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, some efforts to hold the California Water Board accountable. We'll have details on that. But to start off the morning, the Association of Equipment Manufacturers will host the Modern Ag on the Mall event next month in Washington, D.C. Michael Clements reports.
As the Farm Bill remains front and center for U.S. agriculture, AEM is showcasing the latest farm equipment for the public and policymakers. Kurt Blades, AEM Senior Vice President of Agriculture, says it's a great way to tell the story of modern agriculture.
For the second time in the last 3 years, we're pleased to be hosting a celebration of modern agriculture on the National Mall. This really provides an opportunity for those of us in the ag industry to tell the story to lawmakers and policymakers and the general public about what is happening in modern agriculture and the difference that it's making in producing food and fiber and fuel for a growing world.
The celebration of modern ag on the National Mall takes place the week of May 6th, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. It's open 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day. Blade says there are multiple target audiences for the event.
Our first audience is an audience of about 50 to 200 people. And those are those folks that are really involved with writing public policies that are really impacting agriculture. The secondary audience is also very exciting, and that's the general public. That might be hill staffers or just general public that are walking through the mall. So we love to be able to tell those stories. Tractors and combines and pieces of equipment are pretty good eye candy and a pretty good way to lure people in to tell that story to an audience that is less and less informed than they have been in the past.
Blades explains what folks will see when they are on the National Mall.
Well, first of all, the National Mall is a very big place. So if you've been there, you know we're talking football fields in length. And so we've got 25 different companies and 30 different associations representing various aspects of agriculture. And we'll have everything from sprayers and combines to small tractors to robotic milking to irrigation, all of the things that you see on a modern farm today. And the really interesting place of the backdrop of the nation's capital and Washington Monument.
Blade says now is the perfect time to highlight U.S. agriculture on the National Mall as the industry seeks a new farm bill.
The timing of this year's celebration of modern ag on the National Mall couldn't be better, as we are still without the passage of a new farm bill. There are two critical pieces of legislation that AEM is a big supporter of in the new farm bill, and that's the Precision Ag Loan Act and the Precise Act. Both of those bipartisan bills provide incentives for farmers to invest in precision agriculture. So we look forward to telling those stories to the influential audience of Washington, D.C. We like to be in that environment at a very important time while those debates are happening in the halls of the Capitol.
Learn more online at AEM.org. Michael Clements reporting.
The Environmental Protection Agency Friday granted a nationwide waiver allowing for sale of E15 fuels at the pumps this summer. Here's Rod Bain.
Renewable fuels industry stakeholders and supporters wondered throughout late last year and the first months of this, if an emergency waiver would be granted to allow gasoline blended with 15% ethanol to be sold in the summer months.
We were grateful the administration granted the emergency waiver yet again in 2023 to be used nationwide, but we still don't have a permanent solution in place.
We've got lucky the last couple of years because we've had emergency waivers to get us through that summertime barrier, but those conditions aren't always going to be around.
Brian Jennings of the American Coalition for Ethanol and Robert White of the Renewable Fuels Association. Friday, they learned the Environmental Protection Agency granted a nationwide E15 emergency waiver for the third consecutive summer. EPA citing conflicts in Ukraine and the Middle East for their decision. The emergency fuel waiver goes into effect May 1st. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The Bee Sure campaign from the Growing Matters Coalition helps growers protect bees and other wildlife. To learn more about what we can do, I'm talking with Nick Tinsley, Seed Treatment Technical Field Representative with BASF. I wanted to start out with talking a little bit about treated seeds. Why is it important to cover treated seeds?
Sure. Treated seeds are an important tool that growers have in their capacity to help protect their crops and get those high yields they're looking for. And it's important that we use these in a way that it doesn't harm the environment. And so we know that certain bird species, may eat seeds if they're left out on the ground. And so covering them and removing them from that kind of on the soil surface is a really important strategy for helping protect wildlife.
Learn more online at growingmatters.org/be sure. That's growingmatters.org/be sure. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's national spotlight, the global race is on for existing and prospective sustainable aviation fuel. Oil Price Information Service, or OPIS, Biofuels Director Jordan Godwin says the conversation around the evolving sustainable aviation fuel landscape so far involves a lot of promises.
There's been a lot of projects announced in this space, a lot of promises made by airlines, you know, as they set their respective goals of trying to blend more sustainable aviation fuel into their fuel supply, and we've been all over it.
However, tangible results have yet to be seen for widespread production and use of sustainable aviation fuel. Godwin pointed out that it costs a lot more right now to make it than it does to make jet fuel, and that's why tax credits are needed, he says, to level the playing field.
We've also heard that there are people working on these sort of certificates where, for example, when you go to buy your airline ticket, it may give you an option of would you like to add X amount to the cost of your ticket to, offset your carbon footprint or whatever it may be, to kind of ask the consumer to voluntarily help pay for the cost of the SAF. That could be a development that we'll see over the next 5 years or so. It wouldn't surprise me at all.
The Biden administration is expected to release a preliminary climate model for its sustainable aviation fuel subsidy program in the coming weeks. Godwin made his comments during a webinar hosted by OPIS, putting a price on sustainable aviation fuel. Early season crop nutrition programs will get the growing season off to a strong start. Chad Smith has more.
Eric Winans, research farm manager and technical agronomist for Brandt, talks about why early season crop nutrition is so vital.
Typically, when we're trying to maximize yields, we're trying to push the envelope on planting earlier and earlier. But in some instances, we're planting into some cooler soil conditions, and the nutrition that's in our soils may not be mineralized yet. So if we're planting into cooler soils, even though we may have high organic matter, high P and K levels in our soils, a lot of that may not be available for crop uptake right from the start. By the time it starts to emerge, it's putting out its nodal root system. And it's really important that when that nodal root system is going out, that it has access to nutrition, because that's about the time when that crop emerges between emergence and V2, it'll start to come off of its seed reserves and it needs to start taking in nutrition. So that's why having nutrition available is really important.
He talks about some of the key elements in early season nutrition.
One of those being sulfur. We're using ammonium thiosulfate at planting, banding that in a 2x2 placement along the crop row. That can be anywhere from 10-15 bushels plus for us, depending on the planting date. Another element that's really important is phosphorus early season, and just as important is balancing that phosphorus with zinc. Another thing that we don't tend to think about as a starter fertilizer is your nitrogen. As it gets putting out that nodal root system and it's going through those early vegetative stages, V2, V3, it's beginning at that stage to determine kernel rows around on that ear, that early in the season. And it's basing its yield trajectory based on the nitrogen environment that it's in.
Brandt has solutions for different early season crop nutrition needs.
We have our Brandt Ends Up Zinc, so it's a little bit of zinc, typically running that with like a 1034-0 or 1137-0, and it's also got some enzymes with it as well. Enzymes, unlike biologicals, they're non-living, so they're very stable in the soil, and they go to work immediately on breaking down organic nutrition. If we're planting early and we're not mineralizing that nutrition that's in our soils, enzymes are helping unlock some of that nutrition for us early season. Another avenue that's been really successful for us is delivering nutrition through the planter box, talc-based products that we can put directly on the seed. And so we're looking at zinc, moly for soybeans, manganese, boron, iron, a lot of these elements directly on the seed. And we're also able to pair that with those same enzymes or maybe some nitrogen-fixing bacteria, the Homeland products. We have Homeland Corn Complete and Homeland Soybean, which kind of deliver a complete micronutrient package specific for each crop.
Winans talks about proper sulfur selection for optimum nutrition.
I'll add a little bit on that sulfur piece. So we're using ammonium thiosulfate at planting. And it's really important that we're using that source because it's part elemental sulfur and it's part sulfate sulfur. Elemental sulfur has to oxidize to become available. Sulfate sulfur is immediately available for plant uptake and it's very acidic. So we're dropping that pH in that zone of application, helping release some of these other elements that haven't quite mineralized yet early season.
For more information on early season crop nutrition options, go to brant.co. Chad Smith reporting.
That's today's National Spotlight. In livestock news, the news stemming from USDA's latest look at the cattle and calves in feedlots appears to be mixed. Here's Rod Bain.
More cattle in feedlots than this same time last year. A 1% increase as of April 1st. Yet as USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagum delves into further detail about the April cattle on feed report, he indicates,
this report showed a decline in placements, which was below what a number of industry analysts were expecting.
With March placements at 1.75 million head of cattle, down 12% year over year.
The low number of cattle being placed on feed reflects the fact that we are looking at increasingly tight supplies of cattle outside feed. We still remain in the contractionary phase of the cattle cycle.
With expected continued tightening of cattle inventory. Likewise, marketings of fed cattle in March were down 14% from 2023.
Feedlots still are selling off the cattle at a rather slow pace relative to history.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagum explains a marker in measuring marketing of cattle in feedlots and how it could indicate current trends in the cattle inventory.
If we look at the marketing number, the number of cattle on feed over 150 days, which is sort of a marker of what we use to represent how fast cattle are being marketed, continues to grow well above a year ago as a proportion and as absolute numbers of cattle on feed, which is being reflected in the fact that the weights of cattle being slaughtered have been rather heavy.
The National Cattlemen's Beef Association finished a successful legislative conference in Washington, D.C. The three-day event brought in cattle producers from across the country to Washington to meet with federal agencies and their elected members of Congress. This year, 300 cattle producers traveled to Washington and participated in 170 meetings on Capitol Hill. During the three-day event, NCBA members discussed their priorities for the next farm bill, including the need for animal health, disaster relief, risk management, and voluntary conservation programs. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
Six major commodity groups are opposing an anti-dumping and countervailing tariff petition from Corteva Agribusiness. Last month, Corteva filed a petition with the International Trade Commission for 2,4-D herbicide imported from China and India. In a letter sent to the ITC, the group stressed that farmers would unfairly bear the brunt of this dispute between multinational companies, as such duties could restrict farmers' access to critical herbicide supplies. They urged the ITC to vote against advancing the petition, warning of supply shortages and economic repercussions for rural communities. While acknowledging Corteva's contributions to ag technology, the organizations emphasized the necessity of multiple suppliers to ensure farmers can effectively plant and harvest crops. The ITC is set to decide on the case's preliminary stage on May 17th. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network. A coalition of nearly 100 industry groups is encouraging lawmakers to fully fund the Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program. Administered by the USDA's National Institute of Food and Agriculture, the SAIR program supports farmer-driven research addressing issues like carbon sequestration, greenhouse gas reduction, and local food system improvements. The letter emphasizes SAIR's role in promoting farmer profitability, stewardship, and quality of life. Despite its proven track record, SAIR has yet to receive its full authorized funding of $60 million. The letter emphasizes the importance of SAIR's practical research, farmer-to-farmer knowledge sharing, and collaboration with agricultural professionals. The signatories stress the importance of investing in SAIR to help address future productivity challenges, support farmers, and enhance climate-resilient farming systems. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network. Working with state and federal officials can go a long way in helping agricultural conservation be more valued and better understood in a regulatory framework. Previous Almond Alliance CEO Aubrey Betancourt explained how collaboration can be achieved and how it can work for farmers.
We have a unique moment here where if you look at the immense amount of work that's been done with working lands, this spirit or this concept of collaborative conservation with farmers and ranchers across the landscape, and it needing to have a place where it gets credit, it is fostered, and it is protected. A really great example of how I think this is being realized more than ever is EPA signed an MOU with USDA to give credit for using voluntary USDA conservation programs to farmers. These are mechanisms within the law that actually provide protections and provide encouragement and assurances for landowners to actually be part of the solution again. And so it's really important as EPA is going through its processes that it is engaging with Fish and Wildlife and engaging with especially farmers and ranchers and land managers to create mechanisms that protect their ability to continue to contribute to solutions here, whether we're talking about habitat development, water conservation, water quality concerns. These are all things that we as farmers and ranchers know how to do on our operations. And there is unique opportunity here for the law to catch up to the work that we do.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network. UC Cooperative Extension is hosting a Northern San Joaquin Valley Vineyard Irrigation and Nutrient Management Workshop next month in Stockton. The event will feature presentations from various experts and researchers and will take place at the Cabral Ag Center on Wednesday, May 2nd. The first presentation of the day will highlight vineyard irrigation scheduling methods and management practices, which will be followed up by a discussion about the effects of trellis and irrigation on vineyard productivity. Extension specialist with the Department of Viticulture and Enology at UC Davis, Matthew Videlibus, will be going over nutrient management for profitable grape production. After the morning break, there will be presentations on satellite-based tools to track vineyard water use and stress for irrigation management and building soil health in vineyards through regenerative agriculture. More information about the workshop is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Ag businesses can apply for a trade mission to Colombia. Details coming up on This Land of Ours. USDA Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs, Alexis Taylor, will lead an agribusiness trade mission to Colombia August 13th through the 15th. USDA is now accepting applications from current and potential U.S. exporters who have interest in joining the delegation. Taylor says Colombia represents a top-tier food and agricultural destination for American farmers, ranchers, and processors. She says as the second most populous country in South America, Colombia enjoys high favorable demographics coupled with 20 years of continuous economic growth. Colombia is the largest South American market for U.S. agricultural products and the seventh largest market for U.S. food and beverage exports globally. Since the U.S.-Colombia Trade Promotion Agreement was implemented in 2012, U.S. ag exports to Colombia have grown 237%, reaching a record $3.7 billion in 2023. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. Here's Chuck Zimmerman.
I'm visiting with Sean Hoke with Syngenta. And first of all, Sean, tell us what you do for Syngenta.
I'm our corn herbicide product lead, Chuck.
It's good to have you here at Commodity Classic. And I know we've talked about this like last year, and kind of give us an update when it comes to this product Storin that you've got and how it's doing for you.
Yeah, great question, Chuck. We introduced Storin corn herbicide at last year's Commodity Classic. And since then, we've celebrated a lot of milestones. We had our first delivery events at our ag retail partners across the country. We received the first gallons of Storin. And now we're in the process of working with our channel partners and the first growers that are going to use a Storin corn herbicide this summer. We actually launched a Storin satisfaction program this year, and we're asking growers that use Storin to provide their experience, their five-star experience with us. And we're also enabling it with some weather data, weather information to understand how the rainfall activation was and give them confidence that Storin's going to perform in any environment.
Let's talk about the things that are really most important that you want your customers to know who are coming through the booth here to visit.
Yeah, it's really important this year as the ag economy is going through some changes, or it's always like this around February. to stay true with your plan, understand what happened last year from weed control, what the economics are, and stick with using strong residual products. Get the herbicides on before the weeds emerge to maximize your yield potential. And then ask, no matter what herbicide you use next year, ask about, you know, its track record on crop safety. That's really important. And then the broad spectrum control of weeds. We don't know what weeds are going to be here next year. Every year is different. There's 60, 90 years of seed bank that, you know, grandpa might have had out there. We don't know what's going to be there. So ensure that it's a broad spectrum and that you have a good backing from a company like Syngenta with your herbicide.
Is there anything that is kind of on the horizon that you can speak to in terms of what might be coming down the pike?
Yeah, so Syngenta invests a great deal in corn herbicide research. We're the leaders in corn herbicides for the U.S. There's several really promising technologies in our pipeline that are going to bring new levels of control of resistant weeds. Our focus primarily is on water hemp and Palmer amaranthus, controlling resistant biotypes, but also looking at still developing herbicides that are safe for the crop, have flexibility from a timing that growers expect from our lineup of corn herbicides.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Sean, for visiting with me here at the 2024 Commodity Classic. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
Several aspects about decision makers on the farm and ranch level are discovered when combing through the data of the 2022 Census of Agriculture. Rod Bain looks at some of those findings in the first of a two-part series in this edition of Agriculture USA.
The Census of Agriculture, the premier data set regarding farming, ranching, food, feed, and fiber production in our nation. The latest edition of the census, covering the year 2022, provided the Agriculture Department and census users and stakeholders opportunity to learn more about the people within the ag sector.
It's a highlight because it gives us a snapshot of those involved with farm decision making.
I'm Rod Bain. Virginia Harris of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service joins us as we look at the demographics of the 2022 Census of Agriculture. In this edition of Agriculture USA, demographics have always been a key data set within USDA's Census of Agriculture series. What do the numbers reveal regarding the most recent census conducted in the year 2022? National Agricultural Statistics Service statistician Virginia Harris delved into some of the demographics during this year's USDA Agricultural Outlook Forum, just days after the initial set of Census of Ag findings were released. For instance, in looking at farm producers and total farms between census,
the number of producers in 2022 decreased about 0.8% from 2017 to 3.37 million people. This is a much smaller change compared to the decrease in the number of farms, which was 6.9%. This is due to a larger share of farms reporting multiple producers.
With the number of 1 to 2 producer operated farms decreasing from the previous Census of Agriculture, and the number of farms operated by 3 or more growers increasing in 2022.
About 60% of all farms reported more than one person involved in farm decision making.
In terms of structure of farm operation by gender,
farms with at least one female producer are much less likely to be operated by a single person. Most women are involved in farms with other people. Just 11% of farms with a female producer have just one person involved, while men are much more likely to be operating farms as sole operators of that farming operation.
A further breakdown of data on women in farms reveals
female producers account for 36% of all producers, while almost 60%, 58% to be exact, of farms have at least one female producer on the operation. On average, farms with female producers are smaller, both in acreage and in sales.
There are also notable demographics regarding female farm operators by region.
Farms in the western part of the country are much more likely to have a female producer than those farms in the Midwest.
The census, from cycle to cycle, introduces new questions to further expand understanding of what certain data objectives mean. For instance, in the 2022 census, a new question on the survey form asked about marketing decisions on the farm by gender. 61% of male producers make farm marketing decisions, while 50% of women make marketing decisions associated with the farm. Regarding other operation decision aspects,
female producers, their highest participation in decision-making were in the categories of day-to-day decisions, record-keeping, and financial management aspects of the farm. Male producers were much more involved than female producers in making decisions about land use and crops.
Harris acknowledges the demographic of average age for farmers usually generates interest due to increased age from census to census.
The average age of producers increased 57.5 in 2017 to 58.1 in 2022.
Yet,
absolute difference in average age is smaller than we've seen in the past few census cycles.
And regarding breakdown of average producer age by region,
producers in the Southeast and the Southwest tend to be older than the overall average.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Brian German has today's featured interview.
The Natural Resources Conservation Service in California has a variety of resources available to help support agricultural producers. And this morning we're joined by State Urban Conservation Program Manager for NRCS, Annie Congevoda, to highlight some of those services that are available. So Annie, let's start out here broadly with what can NRCS service centers offer to producers in terms of assistance or resources?
Yeah, so NRCS has two major programs that we offer through our service centers. The first one, which is more popular, is our Environmental Quality Incentives Program. And under that program, producers usually come in with a specific resource concern issue, and then we would recommend a practice to improve that natural resource. We do currently have an urban specific fund pool. Urban farmers are a priority that's been determined at a national level. So at a state level, we've set aside funds specifically for urban producers. We also have our conservation stewardship program. This one is more geared towards folks that are already operating at a high level of stewardship or conservation on their land. The deadline for that one is coming up. We have extended that one. So Friday, April 26th is the deadline to submit applications for that. But these programs run every year, so if people aren't ready to submit applications April 26th, then there will be another opportunity next year. You know, for our EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, and CSP, the Conservation Stewardship Program, you know, participants were looking for people who are already involved in agricultural production or forestry management, but we're really open to what that agricultural production looks like. You know, can be backyard gardens or beekeeping or cut flower operations or even people with horses. So we're really, really open to what that looks like, but we're just not in these programs aren't fit for people who aren't currently farming.
And getting into the urban offerings, what qualifies that and what kind of assistance is offered in those environments?
Yeah, so we do a lot of different things. Right now we're not defining the term urban. What we're really targeting is folks that are operating on a smaller scale. So 15 acres or less are what we're looking for in the urban setting. But practices that we offer are things like high tunnels. We just adopted a low tunnel practice, which is very similar to the high tunnel, but it's much smaller and can be moved around from row to row. We offer things like raised beds, cover crops, we help with nutrient management, pest management, pollinator habitat, and there's a lot more that we do, but those are kind of the popular ones for urban producers.
And like you said, urban hasn't necessarily been defined, but there's a concentrated effort, it sounds like, there to help support those that are growing on a smaller scale.
Correct. Yeah, we're really looking to capture folks that are, you know, operating on maybe 15 acres or less, have diversified operations, don't really meet that, you know, traditional ag look or feel, and might not always get captured the best by our programs.
With that, is there a specific size requirement to be eligible, or is it dependent on the program?
So we don't have any size requirements. So no farm is too small to participate in our programs. So could be someone's backyard garden, right? Or, you know, a tiny community farm on a vacant lot. So no size requirements there.
You noted those resources are readily available. And so how do people get started with NRCS?
Yeah, so I would say the first step really is contacting your local service center. And if you don't know who your local service center is, we do have an online locator where you can type in, you know, what state you're in, obviously California, and then you put in your county and it'll pull up your local Natural Resource Conservation Service office. It'll pull up your local rural development office and your farm service agency office. It is going to be important if you want to apply for NRCS programs to work with the farm service agency as well. Farm records are going to be required to participate in our program. So I highly recommend that when you reach out to your local NRCS office, you also reach out to your farm service office at the same time so that you can get that process started at the same time.
Thank you, Brian. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. Now for more news, take the time to carefully inspect your ag tires before heading into the field this spring. Chad Smith has more.
That can help you avoid flat or ruined tires during an important time of year. Austin Fisher, field engineer for Firestone Ag, says it's important to check tires to avoid costly downtime.
It's so important because according to the Firestone Ag downtime calculator, just 1 hour lost during planting can result in upwards of $2,000 per hour yield loss in the fall. Every hour of downtime just adds up and takes away from the paycheck in the fall.
Firestone Ag has put together a checklist to help make sure your tires are ready to go.
The first step is to check the inflation pressure with a good calibrated high quality gauge. If the inflation pressure is not where it should be, then it should be adjusted. The other thing is if you don't know what the proper inflation pressure is supposed to be, then you'll need to figure out what your maximum axle loads are, because that's what the inflation pressure will have to be based on. The next step would be to check the tire sidewalls for any cracks, cuts, bubbles, or other damage that could potentially cause issues in the spring during planting. Similarly, we recommend for the third step to check the tread lugs and make sure that they're not beginning to tear off, or they don't have really deep creasing at the bases, or that they're not chunking out in the center. And then lastly, that they are at least 20% of the depth that they were when they were new.
After that, it's time to dig further into the tread conditions.
The next step would be to check the tread subsurface, so the area between the lugs, what we call the valley. Make sure that there's not any damage there. Typically, what we would be looking for would be any punctures or deep cuts or damage from stubble that exposes the cord. The next step is to check to make sure there's not a large gap between the center lug and the tire's footprint, so that the interface between the ground and the tire, to make sure that the tires aren't overinflated. Now, the caveat to this is the tire inflation pressure has to be set to the worst case load. The next step is to check the valve stems for any cracks, corrosion, make sure it's not coated in debris, and then make sure that the cap is secure, tight, and good condition. And then the very last step we recommend is just to make sure all the nuts, bolts, hardware, etc., in the wheel assembly is tight and in good condition and torqued to the manufacturer's specs.
He talks about where farmers can find more information and support from Firestone Ag.
Well, we have the seven-step checklist and other resources on our website. You can get there by visiting firestoneag.com. Your local Firestone Ag certified dealer would also be a great resource to talk to. We have the Firestone Ag Field Engineering Hotline, and that number is 1-800-847-3364. And then lastly, the Firestone Ag YouTube is a great resource, as we have a lot of training videos on there.
Again, that website is firestoneag.com. Chad Smith reporting.
USDA recently announced the latest update of food offerings within its special supplemental nutrition program for women, infants, and children. Rod Bain reports.
Every decade, the Agriculture Department, its Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services mission area, and stakeholders of the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, WIC, review and update nutrition guidelines and its WIC food package offerings based on science. Deputy Undersecretary Stacy Dean says for the most recent review, such updates include...
We've expanded the availability of fruits and vegetables. Clients will have more resources to either buy in the grocery store or at their farmers markets directly from producers. And the dairy package are offering more choice, so the kinds of package sizes that families can get. And then in our whole grain category, we're offering a whole lot of new choices to reflect preferences of our WIC community.
Such as TEF for some populations in Maine, or blue cornmeal in the Southwest. The latest WIC updates also coincide with the 50th anniversary of the program. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services, Stacy Dean, explains the purpose of what is known as the WIC program and the need to review and update food package offerings related to the latest in nutrition science.
WIC, or the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children. About 40% of our country's babies have the opportunity to participate in this program, and it offers nutritionist supplemental foods. There's a food package for the pregnant, postpartum women, infants, and toddlers who participate. There's also nutrition education for families, really strong support for breastfeeding, and then referrals to a variety of other services. We update that prescription food package every 10 years to reflect the latest dietary guidelines, the latest advice that we get from the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, as well as from other key partners like the American Academy of Pediatrics. And we want to make sure it represents the latest nutrition science, that it's supplemental in nature, and that it also represents the diversity of foods and the kinds of choices that our participants want.
Dean discusses the implementation of the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children with state and tribal entities.
We actually work with states and tribes. We have 89 entities running the program, which is all of our states as well as over 30 tribes. The states will take our advice or the new framework for the food packages, and then they have to make some choices about which of the available options do they want to take, and then there will be some new mandated changes that they have to integrate it into the food packages. I was just in Maine, and they were talking about a particular population that they're serving where TEF is a really important grain. That was very responsive to a local community there. Or in New Mexico, cornmeal may be a really important food to add because that's just reflective of food traditions in that part of the country. States and tribes meet with WIC participants. They talk to their nutritionists. They talk to community leaders about what are the foods that families who participate in WIC want to see.
That's today's Top Agriculture News. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.